I wanted to start with just a brief look at the current state of mental health in the United States right now. Data from 2020 points to a rise in anxiety and depression among all Americans, which isn't really a surprise given the state of the country and the state of the world. We're seeing it in all age groups, as well as a rise in distressed marriages. So the stats say that 1 in 5 adults have experienced mental illness within that year, and then 1 in 6 children, so just 6 to 17, are also experiencing symptoms of mental illness. The treatment rates are pretty somber. It's less than 50% for adults and hovering around 50 for children of folks who are experiencing mental illness and actually seek treatment. And we're also seeing a really big delay in the onset of symptoms and seeking treatment. So the average delay is 11 years, which blew my mind. So we see a large percentage of our population is suffering deeply and suffering in silence and solitude. They can become experts at hiding symptoms, putting on a smile, a mask of feeling fine, saying I'm fine. They get really good at that. Even those closest to them might have no idea of that crushing weight that they carry. And it is a burden, mental illness, made all the more so by the secrecy and the shame that often accompany it. Someone suffering from mental illness sees those around them happily going about their lives, able to take the knocks and get back up again. And they may think, what's wrong with me that I can't handle just a normal day? If others knew how much I struggle just to make it through today, they would lose all respect for me. It would be humiliating. So I pretend I'm fine and I just keep plugging away. As a Christian, there's even another layer to it, right? How can I follow that exhortation to don't be anxious about anything when my life is all anxiety? I can't seem to control that tendency to worry about everything. How can I rejoice in the Lord always, right, when nothing seems to bring me any pleasure and it feels like I'll never be happy again? Am I a failure as a person? Am I a failure as a Christian? In my heart of hearts, I think maybe God doesn't want me because I'm broken. My friends, nothing could be farther from the truth. If you feel discouraged, if you're doubting your call to a life of holiness and heroism in that battle, I'd invite you to look to some saints. There are, if you open a psychopathology textbook to a random page and point to it, you can find a saint that had that disorder. It's pretty amazing. Just a few I'd like to mention as special intercessors for people with depression. Saint Jane Frances de Chantal, she was a French saint who battled depression for decades. She was a young widow, and she never really got over that grief. And she actually founded a religious order in the midst of this battle. And she became known for her outreach to the sick and also for accepting sisters who no other order would accept because of either their mental health or their physical health not being good enough for other orders. And she would accept everyone. She knew herself what that was like, and that gave her extra compassion. For folks who struggle with suicidal thoughts, Venerable Francis Mary Paul Lieberman. This man struggled with severe anxiety. He battled temptations to suicide for years. He would not allow himself near a bridge because he was so afraid that he might give in. So this man, despite that suffering, he went on to found a religious order as well. And he became a sought-after spiritual director, known for his gentleness and for his compassion and wisdom. Severe anxiety we see in the life of Saint Therese of Lisieux. We now refer to her early life as an example of possible attachment trauma, being separated from her mother through death and from her sisters, who were sort of a mother figure when they joined the convent. She was left with crippling anxiety, and that actually became the springboard for her doctrine of the little way, which is this radical trust in God. We see personality disorders among the saints, and those are considered so difficult to treat. But St. Oscar Romero actually was diagnosed in his 50s with obsessive compulsive personality disorder. He battled scrupulosity as a result of that. He battled rigidity. And he battled it with both spiritual direction and psychotherapy. As a more modern saint, he had access to psychological care that a lot of the earlier saints didn't, and he saw it as an integral part of his healing journey. He actually came to a sense of peace with his mental illness. His suffering helped to forge him into this courageous man who stood for the poor and became a martyr, and he called their persecutors to conversion. We see saints that we think may have had schizophrenia. Saint Benedict Joseph Labre was a homeless pilgrim, rejected by several orders, but earnestly desiring to give all of himself to God. And he came to be revered for his holiness. We see saints with post-traumatic stress disorder. Saint Alphonsa, she's a mouthful, Mutta Thupa Dathu, an Indian saint. And she, her convent was broken into, and she was so traumatized that she actually had amnesia. She forgot how to read and write. She did seek healing and found some healing, but that trauma really, really impacted her. We also have saints for addictions. Addiction to opioids, Saint Mark G. Tiang Siang, alcohol addiction, Venerable Matt Talbot, pornography and sexual addiction, Saint Augustine, Saint John the Long Suffering, great name, and Saint Mary of Egypt. So all of this is to say, we have a litany here of people who suffered mental illness and still achieved profound growth and holiness in the spiritual life. So it does not disqualify anyone from that life of profound holiness. And with the combination of spiritual direction and psychological intervention, whether that be therapy, medication, both, that can help each person live that call more deeply. So from there, I touched on spiritual direction and therapy. So what is the difference here? Obviously, they intersect, right? Oscar Romero saw them as two crucial elements of his journey towards wholeness. And there's some overlap because both deal with that intangible experience of being human. They both deal in our mental and in our emotional life. So one big difference is in spiritual direction, the focus is really to help the person to grow in the life of grace. So the director navigates temptations, spiritual struggles, and supernatural blocks to growth and flourishing. Therapy, on the other hand, works more in the natural order of things. A therapist helps us to organize our internal world, recognize patterns in our way of thinking, in our way of feeling, in our way of relating to others. It can also help us gain some insight into the roots of those patterns. It can help us grieve losses and safely experience emotional pain that has been avoided. In doing so, we can gain freedom and flexibility to live life more fully, which really means bonding and connecting with the people that I'm called to love, with my family, with my friends, with my circle, with myself, and with my God. So how might someone know, you know, if they need therapy or if they might benefit from it. I think people who are seeking to grow in the spiritual life can often feel a sense of disconnect between mind and heart. I might hear and I might know and I might believe intellectually that truth that God loves me, but I can even make acts of the will, right, to live in accord with that truth. But there's something that is stopping me, that to integrate it into my heart, something deep within can't take that in. And this tangle of emotional pain can block our spiritual growth. And it could stem from an attachment wound, which we can understand as an unmet emotional need in our past that colors and distorts our view of the world, our view of ourselves, our view of others, our sense of safety in relationship. And that can block us from that freedom that God wants us to live in, that mind and heart connection that truly believes and understands that I am lovable and God loves me in particular. So the human person is so beautifully complex. And the more resources we can offer to the person suffering, the better. So use both. Use them in tandem. Find a therapist who will speak to your spiritual director, and have a relationship there. So the next part is to really dive into what does theology have to say about the question of and the experience of suffering. So I mentioned the word mystery before, and I want to say mystery isn't a cop-out, right? It's not throwing our hands up and saying it's too hard for us to understand, let's just give up. It's saying buckle up and prepare to dig and prepare to ponder and wrestle, because this truth is so big that our human minds are not going to be able to get to the end of it. But that doesn't mean that we can't get somewhere and that we can't grow in our understanding of it. So we're just gonna go into some theological truths that can orient us as we grapple and shed some light on the mystery. Our main guide is gonna be John Paul II. He wrote Salvifici Doloris, which is Latin for saving suffering. And that's the book that I'm gonna draw some of those lights from. I also recommend a book called John Paul II and the Meaning of Suffering, Lessons from a Spiritual Master. And that one is by Robert Schroeder. It was written as a companion to the encyclical of John Paul II, just to make it more accessible. And he does a really excellent job of doing that. So I'd recommend both of those highly. So John Paul starts with acknowledging the big why question. And he says it's human to ask why. Everyone who's lived and breathed has asked, has wept and wondered, right? We are meaning makers. We believe that our world is not chaotic, but it's ordered and rational. So why is there evil in the world? As an abstract question, we can kind of ponder that. And we can go back to what we know from Genesis. God didn't make evil. It wasn't part of his plan. His plan was goodness. But there's aspects of the mystery that are too hard to really penetrate. But one point of light is that he wanted us to be free to love. And so there was a possibility of evil, and sin, our abuse of that freedom, opened that door to evil. So we might be able to intellectually accept that, that the cause of evil in the world was original sin. But that seems to be an unsatisfying answer when suffering touches us personally. Schroeder says, suffering is an intimately personal encounter with evil that seems to demand a more personal explanation. So it's not just why, it's why me? It's why this person? Why my mom? Why my friend? And especially senseless suffering, like the scandal of a suffering child, innocent suffering. Ultimately, it defies a rational explanation. John Paul says, we find ourselves before an enigma, which we cannot honestly resolve by human means alone. And if we give up there, that can lead to bitterness. It can lead to giving up on God and despair. It's important to note here that God welcomes this question. Turning to Him with this question is in itself an act of faith, even when that turning is raw and angry. It's saying, I believe that you are all powerful. I believe that you are all good. So help me. Stop this pain, or at least tell me why you're allowing it. We might think, is it me? Is it something I've done? Is this a punishment for my sins? And the book of Job clears up this oversimplification, right? Job's friends, in the midst of his suffering, are convinced that the only reason for suffering is because Job has sinned greatly. And he's so proud he won't even admit it, right? So they condemn him. But that's not the answer. God says, no, Job is innocent. And yeah, he suffered greatly. And where were you when I made the foundations of the world, right? It's God reminding us that He is so much bigger than we can understand. But it also doesn't stop there. That's still not satisfying. Okay, Job bows before God. He finds some peace in saying, you're right. Who am I to put you on trial? You are God and I am a man. You are the creator. So is it God? Maybe He is not actually all good and all loving. I think in moments of darkness, every Christian wonders that, you know? Why am I met with silence in this hour of need? That silence is the silence of the God hanging on the cross. He chose the cross so no human being has to suffer alone. And really that why, that cry of why, is not seeking a logical reason. A quick verbal answer would seem cold and detached and would not bring comfort. That why is really seeking the comfort of a companion. It's our longing to be seen, to be understood, for someone to suffer alongside us and with us and hold us in that pain. And Ratzinger talks about the word consolation, to be with someone in their solitude so it ceases to be solitude. And that's where that answer comes from. It comes from the person of Jesus hanging on the cross. There's a book called A Mother's Ordeal, and it goes through an autobiography of a woman who escaped communist China. She was there for the Cultural Revolution, the famine, so much suffering in her life. She was a victim of the one-child policy of forced abortion, and she actually was someone who implemented the policy as well. She worked as a nurse, forcing other women into abortion. So this woman was well acquainted with suffering, but had never been outside of China until her adult life. She came to the United States and, struggling to learn English, she found herself in a church, in a Catholic church, in Mass. And she didn't really have any idea what was going on. She just sat and watched. And the prayers kind of went over her head. But the one thing that she kept looking at was the crucifix. And she was very puzzled and captivated because her images of a deity were, the Communist Party didn't allow religion, but she had seen images of a Buddha who was jolly and smiling. She had seen images of ancestors who were pinnacles of strength. And here was this church full of people obviously worshiping a dead man. And why? And what is the story here? She was just captivated by that. And I think that she saw this man, this God, understands me, understands what I've been through and what I've done. And there's got to be more to this story for all these people to be here worshiping this dead God. And that led to her conversion. She enrolled in RCIA, and as her English grew, her understanding grew, and she was captivated, and she found so much healing and peace in the sacraments, in reconciliation, and in the resurrection. So consolation. Another piece that John Paul says is important to keep in mind is that God is on our side against suffering. Some well-meaning responses that people often get when they're in the midst of suffering is everything happens for a reason, right? Maybe this is a trial to sanctify us. Maybe this is all part of his plan. And that strikes us as almost cruel. Right? It's well-meaning, but if that's true, if this suffering is part of his plan, I don't want anything to do with his plan, right? So here, I want us to go back to God's response to the very first instance of evil in the world, when Adam and Eve chose evil, chose to sin, and opened that door. His response could have been, all right, guess you're done. Good luck. But it wasn't. We see immediately a promise is made. Kind of a gauntlet is thrown down. He vows to not leave us alone in our misery. He vows to win us back himself by shedding his own blood. We call that the proto-evangelium, the first gospel. So we see God taking a stand, saying, I am on the side of humanity and against the evil one. And then the whole history of man is this great drama. There's two opposing plots, right? There's the evil one who is we are under his power. There's God who has this plot to win us back. The fall occurs at the beginning. And then the climax is the person of Jesus, right? Where we get so much more of a clear answer of what does God do in the midst of suffering? He comes. Jesus sought out the suffering. They brought the sick to him in droves, and everyone he touched was healed. He wasn't a distant, benevolent figure. He was down and dirty and in the mud and the spit and the laying on of hands. And his mission was to save us from the biggest evil, which was the eternal separation from God. So how that happened was on the cross. Coming back to those two plots, right? Satan had something to do with the crucifixion, right? We see the convincing Judas to betray him. We see the anger and the hatred of the temple leaders. And I think Satan thought that he had won, right? He saw God being killed. And because Jesus is God, in some mysterious way, we can say that God died on the cross. He thought he had won. He thought that he had overpowered God with evil. And just as he was about to gloat over this victory, over the foolishness of this God who loved such folly, just as he was about to gloat, God revealed himself as the master strategist. He had tricked Satan. What Satan had seen as a foolish weakness, that love, that self-sacrificing love, God revealed on the third day as the most powerful force in the universe. So God, his plan of salvation, turned Satan's weapons of evil and suffering, turned them against Satan himself. And how does that work? It works because God's suffering changed suffering by uniting it to love. So it's no longer purely evil. It remains an evil, but it's changed. It can be used to bring about good. And that's the heart of the mystery of redemptive suffering. So we ask, if Jesus' death on the cross was that death blow to evil, if he won the victory, why are we still suffering 2,000 years later? Where is that victory? We could think of this time in salvation history as the epilogue, right? The climax has come and the victory has been won, but the end is not here yet. And Jesus knew that his church, his body on earth, we are part of his body through our baptism, that body would still suffer until the final coming. And he wanted to leave us, he wanted to open up his redemptive act to us. So the kind of confusing verse in Colossians is relevant here. It says, "I rejoice in my sufferings," says St. Paul, "because I make up for what is lacking in the afflictions of Christ on behalf of his body, the church." And that strikes us as a little strange. Like, is there a lack in the sufferings of Christ? Surely not. No one can even fathom that much pain and suffering. And the answer is no, there's no lack, but there's an openness, John Paul tells us. Jesus left his cross open to his church, his bride, to us, because he wanted to invite us to take a part in the redemption of the whole world. So those weapons of evil, the suffering and the death, have been turned against the evil one. They have become our weapons when we are uniting them to Christ in love. So what does that look like, practically speaking? A simple prayer. It's very strangely simple for something so earth-shattering. One instance that helped me to understand this concept was in college. I was involved with a Students for Life group, and they did sidewalk counseling ministry, and they had a unique model of it that saw the importance of being there for women and men after they had the procedure. So they wouldn't just go for the folks walking in. They would make sure they had someone there for everyone coming out as well. And I thought that was just beautiful. Like, what a mission of mercy. So I signed up, and I decided that I would just try and like give someone a pamphlet. And I was absolutely terrified. And being a shy person naturally, and then compounding it with just the fear of rejection. I don't even know what I was afraid of. But in speaking with someone who'd been doing it for a while, she said, yeah, you can expect that. That's called a spiritual attack. You're doing something in a realm that is very attacked. And that's just Satan trying to scare you. And so her advice was to offer it. And what that looked like was saying, "I hate Saturday mornings right now. Thursday night, Friday night, I am filled with dread and I could recognize this isn't normal. It's not, I'm not like under threat. I could recognize the intensity was a spiritual attack. And to the point that I said, Jesus, I accept this fear and this dread. Use it for the people that are coming out of that clinic. Like, even if I don't speak with a single person, I offer you this fear and dread, this enduring. Use it, please, and unite it to the cross. And I'll never know, right, this side of heaven, what happened to those offerings. But John Paul tells us that nothing paves the way for grace more than sufferings. Nothing paves the way for grace more than sufferings. And St. Therese talked about her great physical pain towards the end of her life as money, as currency for souls. So in just making that simple offering of offering this suffering in particular, it enters eternity in a way that I really look forward to seeing, hopefully someday, to seeing what was the impact of even that suffering that I have since forgotten about. How did God use that? I'm sure it will be this amazing tapestry of interweaving prayers and lives and heartaches that the church triumphant rejoices over, because we can finally see that answer and that full picture. I also think of John Paul had a special love for Our Lady of Lourdes. He dedicated the encyclical on her feast day, and he visited Lourdes as often as he could, and he would beg for prayers from the sick and the elderly and the suffering. He saw them as warriors in the spiritual realm. Where other people felt sorry for them, he said, pray for me. I need your suffering. So I'd like to just close with a few, a summary and a few practical points. Suffering is mystery. It's answered by Jesus from the cross in two ways: as an invitation to intimacy, that he wants to draw close to us in the suffering, to comfort us in our sorrow, and also an invitation to a mission. He offers a profound purpose for even the most senseless of suffering. So three practical tips. First is, don't underestimate the power of a morning offering. So as soon as your eyes open up, as soon as your feet hit the floor, make a small gesture of offering. Maybe it's a sign of the cross, maybe it's a formal prayer, maybe it's just a upward gaze to heaven saying, I offer you whatever comes this day. Use it how you see fit, or use it for this intention. And that's so powerful, because in our lives, sometimes the busyness and the emotions of the day might not allow time for making an offering in the moment of suffering. So your day is covered from the first breath of the morning. A second point is, consider giving those sufferings to Our Lady. The tradition of consecration to Mary recognizes her as the wise mom who can see every single child on earth, every single one of us, and who knows every single spiritual need. And so she knows more than I do who needs this exact grace at this exact moment. And so I'm going to trust her with it, knowing that she's going to take care of me and my loved ones too. But it's a radical solidarity, you know, with the whole suffering world, with all the pilgrims who are trying to get to heaven, giving it to Mary so she can give it to who needs it most. And finally, the fact that we're invited to this mission of taking our part in the cross doesn't mean that we should seek out suffering or refuse treatment, either physical or psychological. Jesus wants us to be healed. He wants us to live fully and to love deeply. Thank you.